Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome back to the Toe Meets the Lid podcast. I'm Logan, and with me this week, Tommy and Nigel were not able to join us, but I've got a man who once pitched a perfect game against a team of armless amputees, and that's Andrew. How are you doing today, Andrew?
I'm doing well, and like I said, it's still a perfect game in the record book.
Hey, that's all that matters. And look, it's just going to be the two of us, but I think we can make it if we try. So let's do this podcast to the best of our ability.
Just the two of us, you and I.
Honestly, I only remember the first lyrics of that song. Just the two of us, we can make it if we try.
Make it if we try, just the two, you and I.
And
that's the end of the song. I don't know the rest of the song.
Okay. Well, we might as well make this our musical podcast while we're at it. But anyway, we're going to kick off our week with the traditional what happened at the end of. Honestly, there weren't a lot of crazy endings last week, at least not on the big games. But I did want to talk about a interesting game in NC State at Clemson. NC State actually had control of this game pretty much all the way to the end. Clemson had to fight their way back into it. At the end of the game, it came down to an NC State drive. They had a field goal from the 30. They kind of, I won't say they petered out the drive. It seemed like they just made the active decision that they weren't going to try and get a touchdown. They were just going to kick a field goal at the end of the game, and that's a lot of the time that's what we see decisions be made on, where coaches just feel more comfortable kicking a field goal than going for a certain win, I guess would be the perspective. So they went for a field goal. It was only about 30 yards out. There's no really bad weather unless I missed something. The kicker, unfortunately for him, and as we often see, the kicker missed the field goal. I'm sure he got a lot of crap for it, but then the game went to overtime, and Deshaun Watson does what he does, scored a touchdown, and NC State from there was not able to come back. So that was that's a tough call, falling out for NC State. You just got to be happy that you're in that situation. But considering you come so close, it's really rough to kind of deal with that. As far as the what happens, I guess the real question would be, what happened to Clemson to make them fall so far? Do you feel like they were just underestimating NC State? Or maybe after NC State is just better than we realized, especially after beating Notre Dame and coming so close to upsetting Clemson. What are your thoughts, Andrew?
You know, State's got a really good defense. They've done a good job at stopping their opponents. And Ryan Finley, the transfer from Boise State, has really kind of been a revelation for them at quarterback. He actually threw his first interception of the season. He threw two of them against Clemson, and those were his first interceptions of the season. And I think Clemson, you know, it was at Clemson. It was an early game. State was 4-1, but had a loss to East Carolina. So, you know, Clemson probably underplayed them a little bit and really didn't really expect it. You know, the thing that lost this game to me, though, and I can understand why he did it, but Dave Dorn at Clemson really got conservative, like you were talking about, at the end of the game, driving. I mean, his kicker had already missed two previous field goals. I get that you kind of want to be safe when you're on the road, you're playing the top three team, but I've also kind of felt that you need to keep doing what you're doing, and you kind of get yourself out of a rhythm when you're playing to kick the field goal instead of just trying to play to win the game, regardless of how you win it. You know, I get what he tried to do, and I understand what he tried to do, but I feel there were you could have been a little more aggressive, maybe try to run the ball. I mean, you ran the ball. Matt Days averaged 4.8 yards a carry, so it wasn't like you were having that much trouble running the ball. I think that you could have kind of stuck in your traditional run offense and, you know, tried to push a little more instead of accepting a field goal chance to win the game with a field goal by a kicker who had already missed two of them. I think the other big part of it, even though Tommy doesn't believe it, is Clemson turned the ball over four times. And that's going to hurt you. Because you look at numbers, you know, I mean, Clemson out North Carolina State, they were better on third down. They were great on fourth down. But, you know, when you turn the ball over, it's going to hurt you.
Well, I mean, that's the case with any team. It's you. We talked about this off the radio a couple of days ago, but, you know, it's hard. You're hard to press to find situations where a team has a significant number of turnovers and they still come back to win the game, especially when it's a big turnover margin compared to the other team. Let's see. And before we switch over to another game, I do want to talk about Nigel did bring up the point. Same points you're making, honestly. The kid was 1-3, and he had the, and they were giving him a shot at making the potential clutch field goal. At that point, though, should they have maybe considered using a different kicker, considering his head state at that point? I think that was really Nigel's concern, whereas my thought is, why don't you just drive it down the field? Do you think this is a situation where you should consider switching out, maybe using a different player to make the kick?
You know, it's, I mean, kick, no matter what, I mean, they're an interesting breed unto themselves. It kind of depends. You know, apparently State's had kicking issues back to last year. They brought in a graduate transfer kicker who apparently missed kicks and lost in the East Carolina game earlier in the year. So kicking is something that has kind of been a bit of a thorn in the side for State, which to me then goes back to, why is Dave Doran pushing for the kick instead of trying to stay in his normal offense and try to push the ball and maybe try to score a touchdown? And so you're not having to rely on a kicker that you may not really have a lot of faith in. In terms of changing the kicker out, I mean, that's always a rough question because you never know what you're going to get from a guy, you know, a guy, especially if they'd gone, say, the guy that kicked early in the year got benched for Bamberg, the guy that kicked against Clemson, and then you bench him again and you bring back the guy who got benched. You know, I mean, kickers are just, they're head cases. You know, they're guys that are really just different players.
Fair enough. All right, well, now we've covered that game. There was one other game whose ending you wanted to talk about, and it was the Georgia-Vanderbilt game. Vanderbilt coming into Georgia for Georgia's homecoming actually upset Georgia. Do you want me to describe it, or would you like to take the stage, describe how the ending played out?
Yeah, I mean, that's a game that you go back and you look at the statistics, turn the ball over. They didn't, you know, they outgained Vanderbilt an insane amount, and they still lost the game. You know, I think it's a game where Georgia settled for field goals in the red zone that really hurt them. And then, you know, they're fourth and one with the ball. They're driving to try to win the game, and they run a motion toss sweep to Isaiah McKenzie. You know, you're Georgia. You're lining up and Sony Michel, two of the very talented running backs in the country, and you're going to toss it out of the backfield to a wide receiver. You know, that kind of starts – you really start to question some of the gym play calling. If that's the play you draw up on to continue the game, you know, why not get it in the hands of, you know, your talent so that they can get some good yards.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. For those, you're kind of fading in and out, but it sounded like what you were describing was basically Georgia's lined up on fourth down. They had 1 yard to go, and they run a toss, a motion toss to a wide receiver. When you're Georgia, you've got more talent than Vandy. You're lined up. You've got two of the best running backs in the nation. I'm basically repeating what you're saying. Why don't you just run it up the middle? Do you not have confidence that you can make it like that? Do you feel like you're going to get a touchdown if you trick Vandy and trick him into running around? And then also, I do agree with your point. They settled for a lot of field goals where I feel like if they had still had Mark Richt out there, like fourth and short inside the opponent's territory, he would have gone for it in a heartbeat, I feel like. I mean, you saw that a lot, even though they were behind in the UNC Miami game, you would see them go for it a lot anyway. It just seems like it's a different coaching style, very conservative, and I think it ended up costing them the game. Do you got any more thoughts, Andrew?
No, like I said, I think it kind of you kind of question, you know, what what they've recruited on the offensive line, and is Jim Chaney really the long-term answer at offensive coordinator if he's not going to get the ball into the hands of his playmakers with the game on the line?
And it seems like that's just been the story of the year, is Georgia is actually hurting themselves more than the opponents the way they're playing by not getting the ball to their quote-unquote star players, you know. Sony Michel and I keep mistaking him for Gurley. It's Nick Chubb, you know. If these guys are supposedly Heisman candidates, you got to get the ball to them. But they seem to have more faith in a freshman Eason at quarterback for some reason who just hasn't impressed me so far. All right, well, moving on. Let's go into just the general recap of what happened in the ACC. So we talked about Clemson. Louisville also struggled against Duke. Both of those games were at home for Louisville and Clemson, respectively. Virginia Tech lost to Syracuse, of all teams. It was inside of the dome, so that might have had an effect on them. And despite all this, I think the thing that stuck out to me was just the parity in the ACC. 10 teams in the ACC are two or less games away from going bowling, and this is halfway through the season, which is the highest percentage out of any of the Power 5 conferences. That includes teams like Wake and NC State, who I think, us included, but the majority of people were just kind of writing off at the beginning of the year. These are some good teams. I guess a lot of people are probably going to write this off as some of the better teams like Clemson and Louisville not being as talented, and Virginia Tech, who was looking to make to be the head team in the Coastal, kind of struggling now. But what do you make of it? Is it just that the ACC is a lot closer in terms of talent? Is it that some of these teams should be preparing for some of these less quote unquote less talented teams? What is your stance on the ACC? Why is it always so chaotic, Andrew?
You know, I mean, we've seen this out of the Coastal for a couple of years, where the teams are relatively close together talent-wise, so it really comes down to small things to win and lose games. You know, you look at North Carolina scores late to beat Pitt. Pitt kicks a late field goal to beat Georgia Tech. You know, even last year, you saw a lot of parity in the Coastal that's always been there, but, you know, people talk, oh, it's the circle of suck instead of parity, but then people want to talk about parity in other conferences, divisions. You know, the Atlantic has really for years been Florida State, Clemson, and everybody else. You know, you had Boston College for a couple of years have some talent with Matt Ryan. You saw Wake win it in 06, which was really kind of catching everyone else on a down year. But, you know, I mean, you've got guys like Clawson, who's been at Wake for a couple of years, Dave Dorn at NC State, who's kind of coaching for his life. You know, Dino Babers, who was a great hire at Syracuse and has really enthused that program and brought a lot and really gotten a lot out of Eric Dungy, the quarterback there. You know, I mean, it's still Clemson's division to lose, and they've got the game in hand over Louisville. You know, they've got to beat Florida State, which is going to be an interesting one. But, you know, it's, you know, then you, like I said, you get to the Coastal where all the teams are relatively close together talent-wise. You know, it was Virginia Tech and Georgia Tech for the longest time. You've had some other teams that have stepped up to fight and be in that mantle. And, you know, that's the thing. You look at everyone's schedules, none of the games in the Coastals are really gimmies. You know, anyone could beat anyone. And I mean, to me, I found that fantastic. I mean, I love watching divisions like that where anyone can beat anyone, as opposed to like the SEC West, where it's Alabama and the, you know, the six dwarves, where, you know, Alabama's going to win, and then it's kind of fighting for second place. You know, the Coastals, really anyone can go out and beat anybody on any weekend.
Yeah, and Nigel actually made an interesting point in his notes. He stated that if this were the SEC, it would be considered depth because everybody's playing so close. But since we're the ACC, it's considered chaos. The Coastal, when you hear it from other conferences, it's not that the teams are really talented and they're really good against each other. It's just that there's so much chaos, you know. Who would have thought that Duke could possibly challenge Louisville? You know, What's your stance on that? Do you agree? If this was the SEC East, for example, would this be depth?
I mean, we've seen it for a couple of years where teams talk about coastal chaos or the circle of suck, instead of stepping back and saying, you know, maybe these teams are all just relatively close together talent wise, and it takes the ball bouncing a certain way or a certain adjustment to win or lose a game, you know. And I mean, the national narrative is going to be the national narrative. Obviously, the SEC is helped by the level of dominance they had, where they won, I believe, 8 or 9 straight national titles. I mean, that's going to get you respect. But then if you look at who won that, it was mostly the West and then Florida. You know, and then you look at it now where the East is considered down, you know, and the West is obviously Alabama and some of the more talented teams. But I don't know. I mean, I'm a big fan of parity. I think when you have divisions and conferences where anyone can beat anyone, you know, and we say anyone can beat anyone on a given day, but a lot of times, I mean, you kind of go into games knowing who's supposed to win or who's going to have a better chance at winning. But, you know, I really feel like in the ACC, especially in the Coastal, that you really don't know. You know, you can pick Vegas, you can pick whatever, but, you know, I don't think anyone saw Virginia Tech blowing out North Carolina the way they did. I don't think anyone saw Virginia Tech then losing to Syracuse, you know, in what's really, you know, probably the signature win so far for the Dino Babers era at Syracuse. Now, the Atlantic's been a little more one-sided, like I said, with Clemson and Florida State and kind of everyone else, which is interesting because if you go in and look at the Coastal records versus the Atlantic without Clemson and Florida State, the Coastal has utterly dominated the Atlantic. Just, it's not even close. It's like 12 wins and 4 losses in the past year or so. I mean, it's been unbelievable the level of dominance the Coastal has had over the Atlantic outside of playing Clemson and Florida State. And so it's really amusing to me when NC State fans or some other Atlantic fans are like, oh, well, if we were in the Coastal, we'd blow it. Well, no, actually, if you look at the numbers, you've gotten dominated by the Coastal.
Well, and I mean, if you look at it, it's kind of like the Bama situation in the West. Yeah, you've got one or two teams that are really the dominant force, but the rest of the teams, what are they doing for you exactly, you know, when you've got Wake – we just talked about NC State and Wake are typically the whipping boys. Louisville has always been good, but I don't think without Lamar Jackson, I don't think they would be nearly as good as they are this year. And then, you know, you've got a few other teams like Syracuse and Boston College, and you're like, what are you really expecting out of these guys? So, yeah, I think it's interesting. For me, what it does is it makes the games exciting, and that's what I want to see in college football. As long as my team isn't the one playing. In that case, if my team is playing, I want them to win by 100 points. But that never happens because Georgia Tech is dead set on having me die early of a heart defect. Anyway, let's move on to the team that you talked about in the SEC, the big focus of the world this week, it seems like. I found it funny this week, actually. I think last week in our pick section, you actually predicted that Bama would beat Tennessee by 20 points. But later this week, while you were watching the game, you sent me a GroupMe message that said, wow, Bama is good. Like, you were surprised at how badly they were whipping on Tennessee. And I was just like, yeah, I mean, we knew this coming in, didn't we? I mean, I didn't feel particularly surprised. Were you actually surprised about how bad they were beating Tennessee?
You know, I was and I wasn't. You know, I think I've said multiple times that this may be the most talented team Nick Saban's ever had. I mean, and they've just come out and, you know, outside of the Ole Miss game, I mean, they've given, you know, and the Arkansas game was, you know, they scored a little late to keep that game. The score relatively respectable, but, I mean, you know, I mean, we've seen Nick Saban and the teams he's put together and how well he's recruited. But, I mean, like I said, I don't think we've ever seen, especially, I mean, even on defense, where Nick Saban's put together some fantastic defenses. You know, I mean, you're seeing, was it 10 non-offensive touchdowns this year, 9 straight games where they've scored a defensive or a non-offensive touchdown. Like, I mean, that's unbelievable. You know, I mean, and Tennessee had a lot of guys out injured, and Tennessee had whatever excuses Tennessee's going to have, but – you know, I mean, I expected Bama to run away with a game, but, you know, you're used to Tennessee at least trying to keep it respectable. But, you know, you know, we joke. I don't think they could beat the Cleveland Browns because, you know, the NFL is a whole nother level and monster in and of itself. But, I mean, this Alabama team, I mean, this is on the level of, like, the 2001 Miami Hurricanes team. You know, the USC teams under Pete Carroll, like, the level of talent and depth that you're seeing with this Alabama team. Yeah, I mean, you know, they play A&M this weekend, which is going to be a test. But, I mean, I don't see Alabama – if Alabama loses a game, it would utterly blow my mind this year. I mean, even as good as Ohio State and Michigan have played, Alabama, to me, has just looked so much better than everyone they've played.
Well, first off, I want to say that if you're a Cleveland Brown fan, most of them already believe that the Ohio State Buckeyes could beat the Cleveland Browns. So then it just becomes a determination, well, do you think Bama could beat the Buckeyes? So that's where I draw the line. But,
yes. I do think that Alabama could beat Ohio State. And in all honesty, depending on what happens, it might not be a game either.
And we're going to talk about...
Take that, Buckeye listeners.
Well, we're going to talk about the Buckeyes in a second. And I'm looking forward to talking about one of our topics this week is what do you do to game plan for Alabama? But we're going to talk about that a little farther down the line. The only other thing I want to say about Bama is feels really fucking good to be a Bama fan right now. Like, shit, man.
I know, it's a hard knock life to be on top, isn't it?
Oh, man. It kind of makes me feel bad, you know? But I think I read a story of, like, teams that are, like, used to being champions. And, like, one guy was watching his brother, who was a Patriots fan, when they won the Super Bowl a couple of years ago. And he was just, like, he went to bed, like, when they got up by a certain amount of points because he was like, yeah, we're going to win it. I was like, that would never happen if it was my team because my team never makes it that far. But, you know, that's kind of how I feel about Bama right now. It's like, it's just an expectation. Like, I didn't even watch all the Tennessee game because it's just like, yeah, they're going to win. What do I care? Anyway, moving on. Let's go ahead and talk about Ohio State. So Ohio State faced down Washington. So, we already knew Ohio State, they beat Oklahoma. So,
Wisconsin.
No, they beat Oklahoma earlier in the year.
No, they did, but they played Wisconsin this weekend.
No, I said they played Wisconsin. Oh, whatever. Anyway.
You said Washington.
Okay, fine. They played Wisconsin. They're going to play Washington in the playoffs. So, anyway, they played Wisconsin this week. They played the Badgers, whichever team that is. And that was an interesting matchup. Because I think everybody was still trying to figure out, is Wisconsin a serious team? Like, they beat LSU and they beat Michigan State, but both of those teams have kind of fallen off. They really struggled against Georgia State, of all people, at home. So we came in this game not really knowing what to expect, and boy, that was a hell of a game right up to the end there. Ohio State was on the ropes, and they had to fight their way back into it. That team is clearly still in the race in the West. I think that's something that you cannot overlook right now. They got to look forward to playing both Nebraska down the line, and they could potentially win the West. But what are we taking away from that game, Andrew? Do you feel like – I think a lot of people are thinking Ohio State was the big challenger coming into that game, and they really struggled. Is Wisconsin really that good? Are we just underestimating them? Or does Ohio State maybe need to start game planning a little more seriously?
You know, I think, and again, I think I've apologized to Badger fans 3 or 4 times. Yeah, I mean, Wisconsin, I mean, even on offense, Wisconsin was a lot better than I thought they were. They actually outgained Ohio State both through the air and especially on the ground. I mean, they ran the ball for 236 yards and 5.1 yards a clip against, you know, an Ohio State defense that we thought was going to be pretty good. You know, Wisconsin, in my mind, has become, with Nebraska, easily the front runner for the West. That Wisconsin-Nebraska game is going to be lit, and it's going to be a great game to see what Mike Riley has done at Nebraska. Because, I mean, to me, Wisconsin is the real deal. I mean, this game – even though they lost, you know, you hate to talk about quality losses and all of that, but, I mean, this Wisconsin team really came out and showed me that they're a lot more talented on offense than I thought they were. The defense really hasn't missed as much of a beat losing Dave Aranda as I expected them to. You know, they made some mistakes. They, you know, but yeah, I mean, you lose a game in overtime to the number two team in the country. So really, it's just one of those where sometimes that's the way the ball bounces.
Well, and I think in this,
you know, but
I think in this particular case, this is like a year where it's just like, it's, you got to feel bad for this team where they're so talented, but they drew the three worst possible teams across the across divisions. They had to play.
They really did. You know, having to play both Michigan and Ohio State, who in my mind are easily the, especially with Michigan State's collapse, the teams to beat in the east of the Big Ten. You know, to draw both of them in the same year, and then to, you know, to lose 14-7 to Michigan in regulation, and to lose by a touchdown to Ohio State in overtime. You know, like I said, I mean, Wisconsin, it's a lot better. You know, Paul Chryst has done a much better job in a shorter time frame than I really expected him to do at Wisconsin. I thought they were going to take a huge, huge step back this year, and I don't think I've ever been more wrong in my life.
And as far as Ohio State goes, I guess I'm not really worried about them per se. I think this is something that you, if you're looking at them and you're comparing them again to like a team like Alabama or Michigan, who they're going to have to play down the line, this game is kind, this is pretty worrying, because it's like, if you're at on the road or at a neutral site and you're playing against a team that is better than Wisconsin, you got to be pretty worried. But I mean, they did on the road, they were playing a tough team, they pulled it out. So I'm not sure how I feel about this. Clearly, I feel like they this would be pretty much the most talented team in the country, other than, you know, maybe Alabama and maybe a couple of teams that just haven't developed yet, like Texas and USC. But they've struggled somewhat playing teams on the road and at neutral sites. So I'm not sure how I feel.
Yeah, I think a lot of that stems from, you know, they're breaking in a lot of new starters. Yeah, we're halfway through the season, but they're still playing guys that probably didn't play a lot last year, probably didn't play a lot the year before. You know, they lost, I believe it was 10 or 12 draft picks this previous year, and, you know, the most picks ever taken in the first three rounds in the history of the modern draft era. I mean, you know, you lose that much talent, no matter who you've got coming behind them, you're going to have some growing pains. Now, their next big game is on November the 5th, where they have to play Nebraska, which Nebraska's really surprised a lot of people this year, and especially, I believe, Nebraska plays Wisconsin before they play Ohio State. So you could have an undefeated Ohio State playing an undefeated Nebraska, which would be a fantastic game.
Yeah, and I think the key to that, though, is that Wisconsin, sorry, why am I saying, I'm screwing up all my team names. Ohio State, rather, is getting that game at home, and they're also getting the Michigan game at home as the last game of the season, which is huge for them, because I think the rest of the games I wouldn't really be worried about. You got Penn State on the road, but are you really worried about losing to Penn State? You got Northwestern. Maryland and Michigan State are your other two road games left, and I don't see them losing to either of those teams.
I mean, Maryland's better than they have been in the past, and I mean, Michigan State's kind of collapsed, which that's really the biggest thing that surprised me, is just how awful Michigan State's been this year.
Yeah, so I think this is one of those years where schedule has had a huge impact just in the Big Ten. We're going to see if it plays out that way at the end. Obviously, we're not even talking about Michigan, but there's a lot of big games left to be played, and I'm going to be curious to see how that conference plays out, especially with the Wisconsin-Nebraska game coming up. All right, moving on. So the other conferences, I mean, let's just talk quickly. I don't know that I have a lot to say about this, but we keep underestimating Arkansas, Andrew. I know this is probably because you had to wrestle Brett Bielema that one time, but I just feel really...
And not only that, he cheated.
Well,
we did not agree before the match that it was going to be Crisco wrestling. I thought it was going to be a straight wrestling match. That man dumped Crisco oil all over the ring. That ain't even fair.
Can you blame a hog for oiling up, you know? You gotta be lubricated.
I mean, I just wish I had known. I would have prepped for an oil wrestling match. I was ready for a straight one.
Yeah, it's a shame that, I don't know, if he's been cheating like he has in his other matches, we haven't heard about it, the SEC refs being what they are. But I feel like the team has just played very well, and they've come out with some surprising wins. There's a lot more talent than we're giving them credit for. Is it the quarterback? Is it the running back? Like, honestly, I keep feeling like I don't need to watch these games, and then they come out and pull off some miraculous stuff every time.
You know, Arkansas has been a team under Brett Bielema that has gotten better as the year's gone on. They've had some early season head-scratching losses or games. You know, they had a one-point win against Louisiana Tech, who's a decent G5 team, but it's Louisiana Tech. You know, they lost to Toledo a year or two ago, you know, and then that's the thing that Burt really does for him is he may start out slow, but they definitely are a team that builds towards the end of the season. I mean, and really looking at their schedule, they're at Auburn this weekend. It's going to be a tough game because Auburn's a lot better than we expected them to be. No offense, Logan.
Some taken.
You know, but still, you know, they get to play Florida and LSU, but they get to play both those games in Fayetteville, and they end the season at Mississippi State and Missouri. I mean, it's not unlikely that Arkansas could end up a 10-2 season. You know, unfortunately, their losses are to Alabama and Texas A&M, which are the front runners for the West, so they kind of knocked themselves out of the Western race. But, you know, I mean, I believe 10-2 might be, you know, Bielema's best record since he got to Arkansas. But, you know, I mean, he's done what he wanted to do at Arkansas, you know, recruit big linemen, run the ball, stack them up, and that's what he's wanted to do. And he's done a really good job at it at Arkansas, a place that normally isn't able to out-talent the teams around him. So, you know, I think that's a huge positive towards him. You know, we're saying that now. You know, he may just lose the next three, and we're like, oh, well, that guy, you know, Burt Bielema was terrible. But, you know, I mean, he's definitely done a good job of kind of rebuilding Arkansas to understand what Arkansas wants to do. And, you know, I remember sitting one time at coaches convention at a panel with Brett Bielema, and he made a comment about, you know, at Wisconsin, we play old football. We line up with a tight end and a fullback, and we run and hit you in the mouth. And that's really, I mean, that's kind of what he's done at Arkansas. He's adjusted a little bit because they've had some pretty decent tight ends and thrown the ball a little bit more. And like I said, I think Austin Allen's a really underrated player at quarterback. He just doesn't have an offensive line around him to protect him like he would want.
Yeah, well, and I think Brett Bielema, considering he runs a traditional offense, he's done something very similar to what Georgia Tech does, was he realizes that in the West, with the team he has, he cannot recruit the top recruits that LSU and Alabama, and hell, even Ole Miss at this point, will be able to go out and get. So he's recruited people to the spots that he needs. He's recruited to the locations that he needs with the talent that he has available. And he's done a very good job of it, I would say, you know? You're not necessarily going to get the top wide receivers and anything like that, but he's built up a fantastic, you know, running game despite all that, and he's just really done a good job, I think. Which is surprising
for me to say. You know, Arkansas is the kind of place where there's some talent in the state, and you're going to do good to keep that talent home, and then you're going to have to recruit Texas hard. I think Arkansas is a state that can really make a living in Texas, and I think Bielema's probably, with his personality, a pretty good recruiter in terms of going into homes and meeting with kids and meeting with parents. But like you said, I mean, he's developed his system. He knows what he wants to do. You know, he wants big. I believe I was reading last year that the Arkansas offensive line was actually heavier than all 32 NFL starting offensive lines. You know, so like I said, with Bielema, you know what you're going to get. He wants big physical offensive linemen. They're going to be able to run the ball. And he's done well doing it. You know, they're 5-2 right now. Obviously, you know, they might tank the season. They might not. You know, I think if he wins two, if he ends up winning 10 games and goes 10-2 at Arkansas this year, I mean, that's coach of the year worthy in my mind.
Right. Of course, it could end up like your fantasy football season. He'll just lose the rest of his games. He's playing by the seat of his pants. We'll have to see how it turns out.
I mean, as you like to continue to respond, tell me, I am still 5-1.
For the moment. All right. Last top.
Yes. I also beat you.
Yeah. You're gonna hold that. gonna hold that over me forever, are you? Last topic.
At least until next year of the playoffs.
So the last topic I just really want to quick touch on. The Big 12 has become an interesting situation where you've got a battle between a two-loss Oklahoma. Luckily, none of those are in conference. Baylor, who is currently undefeated, and West Virginia, who's surprisingly flown pretty far under the radar as far as I'm concerned, still undefeated. They had a big win last week against Texas Tech. going on the road, as you were willing to pick against them because of that big road distance they were traveling. Who do you favor in this scenario? I mean, obviously, Oklahoma's got the talent. Baylor came out of nowhere in my mind. I thought after all the scandals they had going on, they would just fall apart. And honestly, West Virginia's got some skilled players who've been around for a long time, and they've got a pretty good coach. So it's going to be an interesting matchup, and all those teams still have to play each other.
You know, from a talent standpoint, in my mind, it has to be Oklahoma. I mean, they are the most talented team out there. You know, with Baker Mayfield and Samaje Perine and Joe Mixon, the wide receivers, that defense, you know, they're the most talented team in the Big 12. But unfortunately, the most talented team doesn't necessarily always win the games. You know, I think they have to be my favorite to win from that standpoint. But, you know, I think West Virginia has really surprised a lot of people. You know, no one really expected them to be where they were. You know, they get TCU at home this week, which TCU's really kind of underwhelmed this year and not been what we expected them to be in Gary Patterson's kind of teams. You know, they travel to Oklahoma State the next week, which I think will be a big one because Oklahoma State's a fairly talented team. They get Oklahoma in Morgantown, which is definitely going to help them out. You know, and they've – but they miss Baylor, or they play, they end the season with Baylor. So I think that might be, you know, and I think that's what the Big 12 hopes for, is say an undefeated West Virginia against an undefeated Baylor at the end of the season to win the conference. You know, they don't want an Oklahoma that's clinched it with 2 weeks to play.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I don't know. Like, I'm kind of tempted to pick Baylor because I just feel like everybody's underestimating them. I don't know what
the hell. The thing about Baylor is, they're a talented team. I don't. They didn't lose nearly as much from last year's team as we thought, and they've definitely done a really good job of handling and dealing with the off-the-field issues. I think they're going to create a very – if they continue to win and they continue to kind of nudge their way into the playoff discussion, I think they're going to create a very interesting situation for the national media and for the playoff committee, because if you have an undefeated Big 12 champion Baylor at the end of the season – depending on how the other teams fall out, I mean, I'm going to be hard-pressed to think the playoff committee will leave them out because of their off-the-field issues, which, like I said, will create an absolute shitstorm in the national media.
Right, but before that, they have to go through, like we said, Oklahoma and West Virginia, so that'll be a thing. All right, well, now that we've done our recap, I'd like to move on to the Bama topic, which is really the only topic you should be concerned with if you're in college football. I jest a little bit, but I mean, seriously, with the Nick Saban has kind of made his structure on being the college football coach. We talked about it earlier. They're the most talented team that Saban's probably had in a few years. They're probably the most talented team in college football right now. And they've blown away pretty much everybody except Ole Miss that they've played against. Andrew, you were the old guy who had – well, sorry, I didn't mean to say old guy. You were the guy who has the most experience in terms of coaching on the field. What's your stance? How would you game plan against Alabama? I've got some thoughts, but I want to know what you got in your mind.
You kind of hope that the hotel meal is tainted and a bunch of the starters end up with some food poisoning issues, but – you know, Alabama really likes to run the ball. They're starting a freshman quarterback in Jalen Hurts. On the defensive side of the ball, you want to try to stack the box and force them to beat you throwing it. You know, because as athletic as Hurts is, and as well as he's played, he is still a young guy. So I think if, you know, if you can somewhat stop the run, you know, but again, I mean, Hurts has got a 142.2 quarterback rating, so you can stack the box and try to make him beat you with his arm. Now, whether or not that's going to work is a whole nother question. You know, I think I'm kind of torn between two philosophies on what to do really with Alabama, because part of me wants to see on offense. You want to slow the game down and keep the ball out of their offense's hands. But as talented a defense as Alabama is, that's a lot easier said than done. You know, they've got a defense that is just statistically in the top 10 pretty much across the board. So they're going to be able to shut down what you're trying to do on offense. Ole Miss had success because they're a very up-tempo, very fast team, and they force turnovers. You know, that's the big thing with Alabama is it's almost you try to play them as best you can, and you hope they make mistakes.
Yeah, but you could say that about any really talented team. You just got to play perfect.
I mean,
perfect.
That's a common way to play is you hope that other teams make mistakes. You know, I honestly don't know how I'd game plan for them because, like I said, they just seem to me to be such a complete team with very few flaws.
Yeah, I mean, Nigel says some very similar things to what you said. You're going to have to stop the run, obviously, and put it on the quarterback. The problem with that is the quarterback is also their second best runner on the team. So you're going to have to spy him to make sure he doesn't scramble. And then at the same time, as Nigel puts it, you got to make sure you have a Major League Baseball team in coverage. That way you can stop them from going bombing it downfield on you. And
But I mean, even there, you know, you play tight coverage, but then they start to throw the underneath game to O.J. Howard and Miller Forrestall, and you've got two very talented tight ends that I don't know if there's a linebacker in the country that can play them one-on-one or in good coverage. I mean, like I said, that's the problem is Alabama's just got so much talent all across the board is you've kind of got to figure, all right, if we can shut this down and shut that down, and they still beat us, you know, throwing the tight end, then that's just something we got to live with.
Well, and that's the thing. You've got to play man, but who has the talent to play man one-on-one? Because, like you said, the quarterback's got that scrambling talent, and also they tend to run screens and sideways run plays. You've got to be ready to get that guy in the backfield when he gets
the
ball.
Or they give the ball to that grown-ass man that is Bo Scarborough and just hit you in the mouth with it.
It's a tough thing, man. I mean, I've got...
You know, I'm really hoping that we end up with a Washington-Alabama game in the playoffs because Washington's a very talented defense with a good scheme who's been able to get a lot of pressure with four down linemen, and it'd be really interesting to see how they play against that Alabama offense.
Yeah, there's a few teams that I think could challenge Bama right now. That's Clemson, Washington, and maybe... I just haven't seen enough out of Michigan. I want to say Michigan or Ohio State, but it's like I just haven't seen enough out of those teams right now. So maybe on those two teams. Louisville, I'm sorry. I mean, have faith in Lamar Jackson, but Lamar Jackson is not a team, you know, sadly. If you could clone him a bunch of times, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, as talented as that Louisville defense is, they're not on the level of say, a Clemson or a Michigan or an Ohio State or especially in Alabama.
Yeah, well, so here's my guidelines to how to beat Alabama. There's a couple ways. Don't take it too seriously, though, because this is not exactly something you can game plan around. First off...
Food poisoning at the team breakfast.
Well, I was going to say police officers, you know, get the local police to do their job and arrest them coming off the buses. But hey, in the Southeast, that's not unreasonable. So first off, you got to have a better defense than Alabama. Which is, I think, why LSU was traditionally the challenge that Alabama faced in the West was because clearly they never had the offensive prowess. They had a run game, but they never had a quarterback. So the way they challenged them was by having a defense that Bama couldn't move the ball against. And how do you, you know, and then it becomes a position battle because you can't move the ball on Bama's defense, but Bama can't move the ball on your defense. So then it becomes... Okay, well, who's going to kick the most field goals? You saw, like, God, it was since I was in college now, but maybe like 6 years ago, the 9-6 game that Bama played against LSU that ended up in the regular season. You'd see something like that occasionally, and that's just how you would have to be. And, I mean, honestly, you don't see it that much because they're so good at scoring touchdowns. The kicker is probably one of their worst positions right now. On that team, on the Alabama team, especially in terms of talent. And then the second way to do it would just be to have a quarterback who can scramble. And the only reason that that works is because it's just a lot harder to play a solid defense against a broken play, and that's kind of what those guys rely on, We saw it last year with Deshaun Watson. It's just hard to scheme against those kind of guys. That doesn't mean you're going to win the game. It just gives you a better chance of moving the ball against that defense, which is so talented. It's just hard to do it in a traditional manner. But the problem with that is, like we talked about with Lamar Jackson and probably a few other teams, like I would compare it to Dak Prescott back at Mississippi State. Gosh, he was a talented quarterback. He could do everything. But you don't really have a team surrounding that guy, and suddenly everything falls apart. You know, if you don't have an O-line blocking, if you don't have a wide receivers who can catch the ball and, you know, run on pace with their defensive counterparts, it's just really hard to deal with. As far as my actual game plan, I guess, yeah, man defense, I would probably try to send at least one extra rusher every time, either as a spy or just as a blitzer to get in the backfield, because quarterback is really their least talented position on offense, as weird as it sounds. That doesn't mean he's not – that Hurts is not talented. It just means compared to everybody else, he's the guy I would expect to make the most mistakes. And as far as the defense goes, yeah, just get as close to the field goal range as possible. And, I mean, if you keep getting first downs on the ground, do it. But otherwise, just try not to make a turnover and take points wherever you can get them, because you're not going to move the ball very well. And, I mean, that's not really a solution, but it's the best thing I can think up.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, a couple of years ago we kind of saw Nick Saban really deal with adjusting to, you know, because his plan was play great defense, run the ball, control the clock, and score a couple of points and win close games. You know, we kind of saw he changed a little bit when he hired Kiffin to a more explosive offense, because I think he kind of saw the changing tides and the shift of the college game to an offensive game, which to me, I mean, that makes, you know, Saban even greater of a coach, because he can see how the ebb and flow of college football goes, and he's willing to make changes instead of kind of, you know, being stuck in what he wants to do, which unfortunately I think is one of the things that costs Les Miles.
Well, I mean, he is human. It's just the problem is it sure doesn't seem like it when you're looking at his record. So it's tough to be in the conference with that guy when it's just like, God, he wins all the time. Well, yeah, he's so good. What are you going to do? I mean, at least when you're in the ACC, you can be like, hey, we won the ACC championship. You know, we played in the playoffs. When you're stuck in the SEC with that team, like, you're not going to make it out of the – you're not going to win the SEC championship. You're not going to make it to the playoffs. You're going to have to deal with Bama every year. It sucks. But, hey, I mean, good luck out there, Texas A&M. You got them next week. All right. Well, Andrew, if you're ready, you can go ahead and take off with your Smith-Smithson report.
All right, you know, another really tough week for Fish and the Kansas Jayhawks, where they just got
did they lose again? No.
They did. They got utterly demolished by Baylor. You know, Fish put in a good shift, 7 solo tackles, 1 assisted tackle, and 1 forced fumble. You know, you feel bad for a guy that's just fighting his ass off on a bad team. He's got 22 solo tackles on the season, 10 assisted tackles, 1/2 a tackle for a loss, 2 interceptions, and 3 pass breakups. You know, he's definitely like the epitome of that great player on a bad team. You know, his down-home homie, Weston Steelhammer, unfortunately Air Force suffered their second loss of the season to a somewhat resurgent New Mexico Lobos team. You know, Steelhammer played a pretty good game, 4 solo tackles, 2 assists, and 1/2 a tackle for a loss. You know, New Mexico's a team that really likes to run the football, so I think that played a lot into that. You know, Steelhammer's got 21 solo tackles, 14 assists, 2.5 tackles for a loss, 1 sack, 2 interceptions, and 3 PBUs on the season. He's definitely a guy who, being from Academy, I think should end up getting a chance at the Combine or somewhere else. You know, the next guy is a guy I talked about earlier, Eric Dungy, quarterback at Syracuse, who quarterbacked them to a win over Virginia Tech. He was 28 of 53 for 311 yards and a touchdown. And then he had 24 carries for 106 yards and 1 touchdown. So he had, you know, 417 total yards and 2 touchdowns on the week. That's going to be fantastic for a guy like that. And then, you know, Purdue just fired Coach Hazel because he's been terrible. You know, unfortunately, David Blough, the quarterback of Purdue, went 30 of 60 for 458 and 5 touchdowns in a losing effort this week that unfortunately cost his head coach his job.
That's a shame. Oh, well. But, I mean, it's not his fault. That's how it goes, though.
Which, that's the next addition to our coaching carousel. Who is Mike Bobinski and Purdue going to hire?
God. Who won't they hire? Hey, Andrew, you should get your hat on. I think that start firing up the computer, send in your resume.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, Purdue's just in a rough spot, being where they are.
They've got
in the Big Ten, being the kind of engineering school in Indiana.
They've got our old athletic directors.
They do. They have Mike Bobinski, who has never hired a head football coach in his entire career, because everywhere he's been the athletic director, other than Georgia Tech, didn't have football. So a place like Xavier or Butler. But it'll be interesting to see who he hires. And it's interesting, on a completely unrelated tangent, Purdue's a school, and it's kind of funny to me why Purdue keeps kind of going back to the well of let's try to be like everyone else. They're a school that tries to compete with less facilities and less of a recruiting ability than everyone else. So I feel they should go to an offense that really is kind of out of the box. I think they're a team that if they really wanted to could look at a guy like Jeff Munkin at Army or Ivan Jasper, the OC at Navy, and really bring in an offense like Georgia Tech has done that kind of levels the playing field with what they're playing against. But unfortunately, fans yell and scream and cry because, oh, that's offense, blah, 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 blah. Which doesn't make any sense to me, because if I'm a fan, I just want my team to win games. I don't care what kind of style of offense they run.
I mean, I feel like that's how most people should feel, but a lot of fans get really upset when they don't see the explosive kind of offense that their school,
well,
they feel like their school
I mean, it's
run.
Fascinating. You kind of saw it last year when BYU was looking for a head coach, and there was the scuttlebutt of, you know, Nia Matalolo at Navy interviewing for that job, and you saw BYU fans like, oh man, we don't want that guy. We're this high flying, throwing the ball offense. And I'm like, well, that's cool, BYU, but you've won like 6 and 7 games a year. Like, cool. I mean, yeah, you can be high flying all you want, but wouldn't you rather have a coach that gives you a chance to compete and win more games?
You would think so, but no, what they really want is they want to see what. Even if it doesn't win them games, they want to see what Oregon did. They want to see a lot of scores. They want to see a lot of up-tempo because they want to have something to cheer for, maybe not necessarily at the end of the game. Or at least that's what they think they want. I mean, people are weird. People are dumb. So, Andrew, I think I forwarded you the email. Would you like to handle Tommy's useless facts of the week?
I don't think you sent it to me. What's his useless fact for the week?
All right. So Tommy's useless fact of the week. He was going to talk about how Western Michigan lost a fumble against Akron.
I know. But damn you, Western Michigan. Damn you, Zips.
We all lost our bets on that one. But instead, he chose to talk about fourth down conversions. So I will quote him directly. Since I allow... Yeah, sorry, I got to... I'm going to try and switch into my Tommy voice. Since I allow my biases to cloud all of my judgment, it only makes sense that the most effective team at going for it on fourth down is none other than Western Michigan, with a 91.67% rate. The only other team with a 90-plus percent rate is USF, a 90.91% top 10. Top 10 teams in this stat also include Kentucky, California, Iowa, UConn, he misspelled Ohio State. Ohio Stat, Houston, Pitt, and Texas. There really is no relation between how good a team is and their fourth down success rate. For Nigel's sake, my regression had an R squared of 48.5%, which means the data is completely useless.
You know, you can tell that we're all Georgia Tech graduates when we're talking about R squared on regressions.
Or we're just really good at statisticians. No, that's bullshit. I don't use statistics for life. They have programs for that. Why should I have to do calculations? Oh, so really quick, he does have some.
Fuck you, calculus.
He does have some additional notes. You would know, you're a civil... Well, I was going to say civil engineer, but that's not true. You're
whoa, right. Whoa, homie. Slow your roll. Still had to take calculus.
So you're not civil at all. You just throw shit in people's faces. Anyway, some quick notes from Tommy. Every team has tried to go for it on fourth down at least two times. The only team that has failed every time is LSU, who is 0 for 3. Unsurprisingly, the teams with the most attempts, except for Indiana, who loves to get stopped trying on fourth down, and is 1 for 11 on the year. Bowling Green forces more fourth downs than anyone. That's weird. Oh, sorry, faces more fourth downs than anyone. They are 14th in the country for punts per game, 42. The top team has 55 punts, and first in fourth down conversion attempts with an astounding 30 attempts, which is 10 more than the second team. 40% of the time, Bowling Green is going to go try for it on fourth down. They are not too bad at it with a 63% rate. For some reason, people like to try and go for it against Washington, who has had 22 attempts against their defense, and they have stopped 10 of those, which puts them in the middle of the pack with this stat. Go ahead.
My question about Washington is, and I'm not sure if Tommy adjusted for this, but if you're a team that's in the lead often, like I would think Washington would be, you're going to have a lot more fourth downs attempted against you because your opponent's going to be trying to catch up.
Well, and that's what I saw in the Oregon game when they played against them. Oregon went for it frequently on fourth down, and honestly, they didn't convert too many, but Washington got it so far ahead to the point where I don't think it mattered. And I think Oregon was just going for it on fourth down to just keep driving down the field at that point. So I'm assuming that's right, but no, Tommy doesn't have anything on that. But anyway, the last one is do not try to go on fourth down against Duke. They have a stonewalled all 8 attempts against them. I know it is Duke and all, but I think it's time people stop trying. We're going to see how that works for us on homecoming, because I guarantee you PJ is going to go for it on fourth down at least once. All right. Well, Andrew, unless you have anything to add, we're going to wrap it up here. You good? Yeah, it sounds like he's good. All right, so thanks as always to our listeners.
No, sorry, I'm back.
Okay.
So I actually agree with Tommy. I think fourth down conversion rate's kind of a not very useful stat. I'd be much more interested in third down conversion and third down conversion defense, because I think that, in my mind, can play a bigger role, especially third down conversion defense where you're really trying to get the other team's offense off the field, and it's also a statistic that Georgia Tech has been very poor at recently. But
I mean, I would agree. I think, honestly, I don't know. He doesn't have Georgia Tech stats. He didn't give them up to me, but I would assume Georgia Tech would be better at the fourth down than they would at the third down, traditionally. But for this year, it's kind of a crapshoot.
It's really interesting. Georgia Tech in 2014 had the highest fourth-round conversion percentage since the stat was capped. It was in the mid-50s, but then utterly regressed miserably last season. And obviously, you can see how bad we were on offense. And then we've gotten a lot better on this season, you know. But like I said, I think third down defense is really an interesting stat too, because it kind of tells you how good your defense is at getting off the field.
That's definitely a big factor, especially for defenses like, hey, Alabama. Anyway, that's it for the.
I don't think it really matters for a team like Alabama. Their defense is probably going to outscore your offense anyway.
They'll probably get off the field on the second down, to be honest. Anyway. All right, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. Thanks, as always, for listening. Check out our website with more posts at toemeetsleather.net. Until next week, have a good rest of your time. Bye-bye.